Hope we don't study all that often, but I hope I'll meet you there in just a couple of minutes. While you're turning there, we'll make one quick announcement. If you saw the signs this morning coming in, if you are 65 or older and have not yet signed up for the holiday banquet, which is coming up in a couple of weeks, the deadline to sign up for that is next Sunday. The sheets are back there. They're getting full. We've got another one made just in case we fill those up. But we're looking forward to having that in just a couple of weeks now. Literally months of preparation have gone into it. But if you are 65 or older and haven't signed up yet, make sure you do that tonight. And be looking forward to that event coming up in just a couple of weeks. We live in a time and a culture in which the subject of idolatry is one that's not talked about all that much. I think maybe the reason for that, at least in part, is because we think of idolatry as something that was practiced just way back in ancient times, or maybe if it's practiced today, it's just practiced over in some kind of remote, small part of the world that we don't know much about anyway, and that sort of thing. But maybe that's because that when we think of the word idolatry, our view is sort of skewed. Because when we think of the word idol, our minds often just go back to a statue. You might think of the golden calf in the Old Testament or something like a totem pole or something. And in our mind, idolatry, idol, always seems to be something that has to be built or carved or set up and those sorts of things. And certainly that is a type of idolatry. But we need to remind ourselves that idolatry is really just anything that we put before God, or anything that we allow to take the place of God. And if you have one of the handouts for tonight, you can just write your own version of that in the introduction there. Just something that we allow to take the place of God, or we put before God in our minds. It doesn't have to be, although it could be, it doesn't have to be something that's carved out of wood or fashioned out of stone or metal. And so tonight, we're going to think about idolatry. When you saw the title in the bulletin, if you did, put them away and be quiet, you may have thought this was a lesson on parenting. Or you may have thought this was a lesson on technology or something. Put them away and be quiet. Or, you know, cell phones in church. Maybe that's what it's about. I don't know. But we're going to look at a passage tonight, just three verses from the middle part of that Old Testament book of Habakkuk, that reminds us of that we need to put idols away and that we need to be quiet before our God. If you found that passage yet, that book yet, Habakkuk, turn to the second chapter, Habakkuk chapter 2. And we're going to read together the last three verses of that chapter. Habakkuk 2, verses 18 through 20. And that will serve as our text for tonight. Habakkuk 2, beginning of verse 18. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Now, if you have a handout, you'll notice we're going to look at some other passages tonight, but the outline is going to come from those three verses. And if we look at two things, really, we're going to think about putting them away and why we put idols away from our lives. And then we're going to notice the opposite of that God provides for us what idols cannot. And then we're going to think about, we're going to ask the question, really, are there any idols in our lives today? First of all, tonight, think about some reasons why we need to put idols away from us. Number one, we need to put them away because idols bring no benefit. They bring no benefit. In that text we read together, Habakkuk asks a rhetorical question. What profit is it? What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? Now, in asking that question, Habakkuk is not really asking a question. He's making a point, because the answer is implied in the question itself. There is no benefit. There is no profit for that person, or at least no major profit or no long-term profit. The word that's translated profit here literally came from a word that meant to ascend. And that makes sense if you really think about it. Because if you put money in the bank or in an investment, you hope it ascends. You hope it goes up. And that's the profit that you earn on what you have put your money in, that investment or that bank. And so when you put that in the context, Habakkuk is saying that the idol does not really help your life go up. It doesn't help your life ascend. There is no real benefit to your life from it. Other Old Testament writers would point out the same thing as they tried to get people to see the absolute, complete uselessness of worshiping something that they themselves had created. In Isaiah 46, verses 6 and 7, that writer said, "Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh out silver on the scales, they hire a goldsmith, and he makes it into a god. And then they fall down and worship. They lift it to their shoulders, they carry it, they set it in place, and it stands there. It cannot move from its place. If one cries to it, it does not answer or save him from his trouble." Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 8 ends with that prophet talking about false prophets who went about things that do no profit or that make no benefit. You know, when you step back and think from it, those simple points that God's prophets are trying to make is that nothing good really comes from building or serving or worshiping an idol. They do not take our lives up. They don't improve our lives. They don't benefit our lives at all. In fact, what idols often do is make more of what our darkest desires can be. Because in reality, worshiping an idol becomes worshiping ourselves. Because we project what we want to do into that worship or into that service. And then beyond that, so often, we begin to become like that which we worship and which we serve. We'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. But think first of all about the fact that idols bring no benefit. Number two, idols need to be put away from us because idols do not build confidence. They do not build confidence. And I suppose you may want to take some extra notes here on your handout because of the four things that we're going to mention about idols. This was the one that was most difficult to put into short words. But it comes from that four-word description in the middle of verse 18. As the prophet said, that they are a teacher of lies. That four-word description, a teacher of lies. And the point that we're trying to make here from that simple statement is that it points out the absolute absurdity of worshiping something that never teaches anything. How can we possibly feel more confident in what we worship if we have to build it, we have to move it, we have to set it down, and then we never hear from it? You may want to keep your finger in Habakkuk chapter 2 and turn back to Isaiah chapter 44. We're going to have a long reading here, longer than we usually do. But in Isaiah 44, you have one of the most explicit passages in all the Bible about just how absurd it is to worship an idol. In Isaiah chapter 44, beginning in verse 9, we're going to read all the way through verse 20. The prophet gives a huge description of just how absurd this really is. Isaiah 44, beginning in verse 9. "All who fashion idols are nothing, and the things they delight in do not profit. Their witnesses neither see nor know, that they may be put to shame. Who fashions a god or casts an idol that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his companions shall be put to shame, and the craftsmen are only human. Let them all assemble, let them stand forth. They shall be terrified, they shall be put to shame together. The ironsmith takes a cutting tool and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammers and works it with his strong arm. He becomes hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint. The carpenter stretches a line. He marks it out with a pencil. He shapes it with planes and marks it with a compass. He shapes it into the figure of a man, with the beauty of a man, to dwell in a house. He cuts down cedars, or he chooses a cypress tree or an oak tree, and lets it grow strong among the trees of the forest. He plants a cedar, and the rain nourishes it. Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Also, he makes a god and worships it. He makes it an idol and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over the half he eats meat. He roasts it and is satisfied. Also, he warms himself and says, 'Aha, I am warm, I have seen the fire.' And the rest he makes into a god, his idol, and falls down to worship it. He prays to it and says, 'Deliver me, for you are my God.' They know not, nor do they discern, for he has shut their eyes, so they cannot see, and their hearts they cannot understand. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, 'Half of it I burned in the fire, I also baked bread on its coals, I roasted meat and have eaten, and shall I make the rest of it into an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood?' He feeds on ashes. A deluded heart has led him astray, and he cannot deliver himself or say, 'Is there not a lie on my right hand?'" Now, I know that's a long reading. We don't usually read a passage of that length. But do you see the absolute absurdity that Isaiah is trying to get people to see? They make something, specifically in part of that passage, they have a tree, and they take part of the wood of that tree, and they roast their meat, they have their food there, they take the other part of the tree and build an idol, and they have built the idol and fall down and say, "This is my God, please deliver me." While they themselves have made a fire out of the other half of that tree. And Isaiah is trying to get them to see, how can you possibly have any confidence in a God that you built when the other half of what you built, you burned up to cook your meal? Homer Haley wrote it this way: the idol is a teacher of lies. It promises what it can never produce. Idols cannot build confidence. Number three, idols do not communicate. They don't communicate. In our culture, we don't typically pronounce woes on people, but we read that terminology in Scripture, we get the point, we know what's going on. It's a tragedy, it's something that leads to disaster. The Hebrew word is translated in the Old Testament often as woe. It's sometimes also translated as alas. Sometimes it's just translated as the letter O. It's an interjection. It carries three purposes. It carries the purpose of a threat or a warning. It carries the purpose of a cry of lament, and can also carry the purpose of an admonishment. And at the beginning of verse 19 of our text, Habakkuk pronounces a woe on those who serve idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, and to a silent stone, arise. It is fitting that Habakkuk would use that word, woe, there, because this is a warning to wake up. It is lamentable that anyone would do this, and it's an admonishment to the people to stop and to change. These people are talking to something that they feel like they have to rouse up, and then they're worshiping that very same thing. But it's also tragic, because they're seemingly praying to this thing, this deity, represented by an idol, who never answers them, because it can't. It's reminiscent of those prophets in 1 Kings chapter 18, we talked about them a few Sunday mornings ago, who cried out to their god Baal all day long, basically. And 1 Kings 18:29 comes back with that horrible statement: no one answered, no one paid attention. Idols don't communicate. They don't listen because they don't have ears, even if there's actually an ear fashioned on the side. They don't speak because they really have no mouth, even if someone fashions a mouth on it. They're not able to communicate. And to sum it all up, number four, idols are dead. Did you notice how verse 19 ended? There is no breath in it at all. Now, of course, we know that. And anyone who's thinking about this logically would know that. But how sad is it that Habakkuk has to actually vocalize that to people who are living and worshiping and serving this thing, these things, as if they actually have life in them. And in reality, everything we've already said about idols falls under this point. They're not living. They're not real. Now that's a list, those four things. That's a list we all know. We haven't said anything yet so far that none of us don't understand and hopefully don't follow and appreciate. But we're going to circle back to in a moment to make the contrast. We need to put idols away from us, but we need to replace them with something else. In reality, we need to replace them with someone else. And that, of course, is Jehovah God, because he stands in absolute contrast to each of the four things that idols are not or cannot do. We need to be silent before God, number one, because he always benefits those who serve him. He always benefits those who are faithful. If we were to stand here tonight and list every way in which God benefits his people, well, we wouldn't be standing here tonight. I would need a chair. We'd probably need a bed. It's going to take a while. If we were to try to list every single way in which God benefits those who are faithful to him, just think about a handful. We mentioned a couple of these this morning. Every good and perfect gift comes from him, James 1:17. We could list the benefit of a personal care, 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 7. He cares for you. We could list the benefit of an absolutely unimaginable love. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, John 3:16. We could list the benefit of deliverance. He delivers his people, Psalm 34 and verse 19. We could list tons of verses that talk about the benefit of salvation from sin. And the list goes on and on and on. And you are probably thinking of other benefits, either specific or general, that God gives to those who follow him, which is part of what makes it awesome to consider that we really could not ever exhaust the list of the ways in which God benefits his people who are faithful. But also he contrasts idols because he is always worthy of our confidence. We should know that because he is the one who gave us all things, even, as a passage we mentioned this morning, the life and the breath that we have, Acts 17, verses 24 and 25. From the very beginning, mankind has been dependent upon God. Genesis 2:7 makes it clear that God breathed into mankind's nostrils the breath of life. And so from the very first breath, literally, on earth, we have been absolutely dependent upon him. So how silly and how foolish is it for people to worship what has been created rather than the one who created it all, who rules over it all, and who holds it all together? Paul describes that contrast in Romans chapter 1 and verse 22 when he talks about those who would worship the created things, and he said they became fools. And he says because they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images representing mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. But if we're worshiping him, worshiping God, he should always have our confidence. Why? Because he made us. He knows us. He understands all that's around us. He's in charge of all that's around us. And he knows what's best for us, both in this life and, of course, in eternity. Why would we ever want to exchange that to serve or worship something or someone else? But God also contrasts idols because he communicates by speaking and by listening. An idol can't hear, nor can it talk. God does both, and does so with our best interests in mind. He has spoken to his people from the very beginning. He might do so in various different ways throughout the years, but he has always spoken. Is that not how the book of Hebrews begins? Long ago, at many times, and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers through the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by or through his Son. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. God may not speak to us audibly anymore, but he still communicates his love for us and his will for us through the pages of Scripture. The New Testament is what God's Son, Jesus, wants us to know and what he demands of us to be faithful. There's no way to make this list perfect, but if you think about what God has communicated through the New Testament to us, he has communicated the encouragement we need. He has communicated the warnings that we need. He has communicated the promises that we need. He has communicated the commands that we need. And he's communicated all of those for this life and for eternity. And you can expand that list, I'm sure. But God also listens to us. Communication with God is not just a one-way street. It's not just that God speaks to us through his word, but God also allows us to speak to him through prayer. We often teach our children that. But sometimes do we need to be reminded of that, that communication with God is a two-way street. We hear from him through his word, and we speak to him through prayer. What a wonderful blessing it is to know that we can go before the very creator of the universe with everything that's on our heart, who spoke about this morning, and know that what we share before him, share with him, will have a fair hearing. In fact, the Bible would go so far as to tell us that we can even come before his throne boldly. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 16. There's still a reverence there, but there's nothing to fear for those who are faithful. Because our God is a communicating God. He speaks and he listens. And of course, God stands in contrast with idols because he is not dead. He is alive. We sing it, but do we ever really believe it? There is a God. He is alive. 728b, right? If you use those songbooks growing up. In contrast to dead idols, God is living and God continues to work in the world. Paul would write in Philippians 2 and verse 13, "For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure." I'm not sure I understand everything about that passage. And I'm not sure I understand every way in which God works. But the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, make it clear that God does continue to work through his word, through providence, through his people, and even through nature as we see his glory displayed there. He is alive. He is not dead as idols are. Now, all of that, again, is stuff that we know. And probably everyone in this room would go, yeah, I knew all of that. I appreciate all of that. I haven't really had any trouble with that. So is there any real application? I mean, I don't really think anyone in this room has a problem with building metal statues at their house and then bowing down to them. In all my years of being a youth minister and a preacher, I've never had anybody come to me and confess that you know, in their basement or in their backyard or something, they were building a statue of a bird and they were going to have built some religion. I've never had that happen. I guess it's possible one of these days it could happen, but I've never really had anybody with that problem. But how do we begin? What's our definition of an idol? It doesn't have to be something that we build or create out of wood or stone or metal. It is anything that we place before God. It is anything that comes before God. And in reality, anything else that we have can be put before him. And so if we are putting anything before him, it is something that he has created. In other words, something that he created and we took it and changed it, exchanged it, to use Paul's word, into a god. So where does it get us if we do that? Well, If we worship money, for example, what good does it really do us? It isn't alive. It doesn't hear from us. It doesn't speak to us. In reality, it's just a lifeless piece of green paper with a picture of someone who's dead on the front of it. If we let technology like our smartphones rule our lives, what good does that do us, really? They don't have a mouth. They don't have ears. They're dead. It's not communicating with us. Those are just a couple of examples. We could go on and on and on. But I want us to go back to something I said we were going to circle back to a few minutes ago. Remember we said we often become like what we worship? So if we worship things like the stuff that we have, money or technology or whatever it is, if we worship the stuff that we have, what do we become? I put this quote on the back of your handout because I wanted you to have a copy of it. I think it's worded better than I ever could possibly word it. Tom Rinke wrote this. He said, "This is extremely clear in Scripture. To love and worship a dead idol is to become like the idol. If our idols have no hands to embrace us, no eyes to see us, no mouths to assure us, and no ears to hear us, then we who worship idols become like them, spiritually powerless, blind, mute, and deaf. Our idols dehumanize us. They petrify our souls and dumb and dull and deaden all of our spiritual senses." If you don't believe me, watch someone who is worshiping technology for a few minutes. Because eventually, they'll become slack-jawed. They'll be disinterested in others. And they'll be non-communicative. Why? Because what they're worshiping is just like it. Look at someone who worships money or fame or power. They will slowly over time become less caring about other people. They will slowly over time become more unwilling to listen. And they will slowly over time only begin to think about themselves. Why? Because that's what they're worshiping. They're worshiping what gets them, what puts them up in society. So why wouldn't they just become more and more and more of that? What is the solution? The Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him. I need to put those things away and be quiet before my God. We sometimes sing a song that I absolutely love. Simple, the wording is, the chorus, "I stand in awe of you." I love that song. But I wonder sometimes when I sing those words, do I really mean them? Is there ever a time when I really look around at the things of this world, at the things that God has created, the beauty of the creation, the relationships that we have, the glory of the church, the Word of God, and really just stand in awe of God to the point that I am speechless at how powerful He is, how loving He is, how amazing He is, and that He would do all of that with each one of us, including me, in mind. Why then would I take something that He created, like a tree or a piece of paper or anything else, and place that before Him? When I look at Him, and my mind is absolutely blown away, and I stand in awe. Not slack-jawed, but jaw set in. And so there is a time in life to put those things away and to be quiet before our God. Let me ask you tonight, are you really standing in awe of Him? Or are you bowing your life to the lower, the baser, the lesser things, which is anything other than? You need to come to Him tonight. Do you need to return to Him tonight? Whatever your need is, will you come? Will you stand and sing to encourage you?